Keeping a diary is a childish habit, but this childish habit may now be worthwhile, even to a serious man. It is clear we are now entering the storm of revolution. At a meeting yesterday of deputies, politicians, scholars, and writers, even the most conservative man talked about the coming revolution as a certainty. Counts and barons, landlords and businessmen all applauded scathing criticisms of the government and acclaimed the approaching revolution. These men, weary, effeminized, accustomed to lives of comfort, calling for revolution, presented a curious spectacle. Like heedless children, they manifested a curiosity and a joy in meeting such an interesting development. I had a vision of the French ruling classes before the 18th century revolution. Like these Russians, their emasculated aristocracy too greeted the storm with laughter, not reflecting that it might rob them of their property and even of their lives. "Do you think that the guillotine will be necessary for us also in the near future?" asked one of my students in the Workers' University of Petrograd. "I do not know," I replied, "but I am certain that if you contemplate the guillotine for your enemies, the same guillotine will cut off your head a little later. The guillotine always kills first the well-fed, but later on it gets to the poor also. Do not forget this. It may be useful to you if revolution really comes." Street demonstrations of poor women and children demanding bread and herrings, eternal voice of all revolutions, had previously led to the looting of one or two shops, but today the demonstration became larger and noisier. The rioters today stopped tram cars, turning over some of them, plundering a good many shops and even attacking policemen. Many workmen have joined the women and a general strike and great excitement resulted. After the wrecking of the trams, something more important may next be overthrown. The Tsar's throne, for instance. Things are drifting that way. If future historians look for the group that began the Russian Revolution, let him not create any involved theory. The Russian Revolution was begun by hungry women and children demanding bread and herrings. Only later did they, together with workmen and politicians, become ambitious to wreck that mighty edifice, the Russian autocracy. It goes steadily on. Yesterday, 3 men and 1 woman were killed. Today, more. The orderly routine of life is broken. Shops and offices are closed. In the university, instead of lectures, political meetings are held. Newspapers appear irregularly. Revolution has pushed 1 foot over the threshold of my country. Today, the same. Crowds on the Nevsky Prospect are larger. The police are idle and irresolute. One hears that even the Cossacks have refused to disperse the crowds. This means that the government is helpless and their machine broken. Rioters have begun to kill policemen. The Pavlovsky Regiment is in revolt. We are told that the Minister of the Interior is recruiting special squads of police and is equipping them with machine guns to be placed on rooftops for merciless suppression of demonstrations. This half-mad paralytic can do nothing much, however. The end is very near. Or it is only the beginning. It has come at last. At 2 o'clock in the morning, just now returned from the Duma, I hastened to set down the stirring events of the day. At noon, telephone service was discontinued, and undisturbed, I resumed my studies until about 3 o'clock, when one of my students rushed in with the news that 2 regiments, armed and carrying red flags, had left their barrack and were marching on the Duma, there to unite with the workmen. "Is this true?" I exclaimed incredulously. "I saw them myself," he replied. Hastily leaving the house, we hurried to the Troisky Bridge. Here we found a large but orderly crowd listening to the firing and greedily drinking in every bit of news. Nobody knew anything positive. Cavalry police kept the crowds in check and allowed nobody to cross the Neva. Boom! Rat-a-tat-tat! Rat-a-tat-tat! "Who's firing? On whom?" "Let's go to the central part of town," I suggested. "We may learn something there." "Pharaohs, your end is coming," howled the mob. From where we stood, we could see the red glow of fire near the Nikolaevsky station. At last, at last, cried a man pointing to the ominous reflection. What's burning? I asked. The police station, he exulted. But there is a fire station in the same building. That won't help. We're going to destroy all government offices. Burn, smash, kill all police, all tyrants, all despots, he cried in frenzy. Revolutionists are prepared to defend their Duma, said my friend Kuzmin, with approval. On the contrary, I replied, a crazy mob is forcing the Duma into a revolution which it does not want. You will soon behold the real object of this demonstration. Comrade Sorokin, at last! Revolution! At last, the day of glory has arrived, cried one of the workers. My student! Others with him approached me joyfully. In their faces was the light of hope and exultation. What are you doing here, boys? I asked. We were told here to come and help organize the Soviet of Workmen, as in the Revolution of 1905. Why is a Soviet necessary? I asked. To defend the revolution and the interests of the workers, to control the government and to proclaim our dictatorship, they replied. You'll join us, won't you? I haven't been elected, thank you, I returned dryly. Neither have we been elected, but that doesn't matter. In such times, such formalities are needless. I don't agree with you, I said, and I added, it may be for the defense of the revolution a workmen's committee will have to be formed, but be careful about any dictatorship. Food was being brought in, a buffet was set up, and girl students began to feed the soldiers. This produced a sudden lull, but outside I learned things were going badly. Fires continued to break out, the people were growing hysterical with excitement, and as for the police, they had retreated. Again, I sought the courtyard of the palace. The fever of liberty had by this time fairly intoxicated the multitude. Wild speeches and shrieks of applause filled the air. Excited, in spite of myself, I too listened and applauded, and it was midnight before I could tear myself from the place. As no trams or cabs were to be had, I walked a long distance from the Duma. It was very dark and no street lamps burnt. Incessant firing reached my ears, and sometimes the firing seemed so near that all pedestrians stopped, looking around for shelter. Groups of citizens huddled against the walls of houses to avoid flying bullets. There blazed a very fierce fire, the magnificent building of the High Court being in flames. Who started that fire? Someone exclaimed. Is it not necessary to have a court building for New Russia? The question went unanswered. We could see that the other government buildings were also burning, among them police stations, and that no efforts were being made to extinguish the fires. On the faces of many spectators of this destruction were expressions of intense satisfaction. Their countenances, in the red blaze, looked demonic as they shouted, laughed, and danced. Here and there were heaped wooden carvings of the Russian double eagle, and these emblems of empire, torn from shops and from government buildings, were being thrown on the fires to the cheers of the crowd. The old regime was disappearing in ashes, and no one regretted it. No one cared even when the fires spread to private houses. Let them go, one man said defiantly. When wood is chopped, chips fly. At 2 o'clock I reached home and sat down to write these hurried notes. Am I glad? Or am I sorry? I can hardly tell, but certainly in my mind are persistent apprehensions. Tonight, only a part of the city is in the hands of revolutionists. But what will happen tomorrow? How long will this disorder continue? How many lives will be taken? Will these events weaken or perhaps even destroy the army? Is it possible that this may result in the invasion of Russia by the Germans? It seems a terribly dangerous time to launch a revolution. But perhaps my premonitions are foolish. So many rejoicing and patriotic people cannot be wrong. Who was it that said, individuals may be mistaken, but a whole nation, never? Very well, long live the revolution. The autocracy had to be destroyed sometime, therefore, away with my doubts and premonitions. I looked at my books and manuscripts. I suppose they will have to be put aside for a time, I reflected. This is no time for study. Action is the thing. Goodbye, beloved friends. Today, the Hall of the Duma presented quite a different picture from yesterday. Soldiers, workmen, students, citizens, men and women, young and old, crowded the place. Order, cleanliness, and restraint were conspicuous by their absence. His Majesty, the people, were master of the scene. In every room and corner were meetings and much loud oratory. Down with the Tsar, death to all enemies of the people, long life to revolution and the Democratic Republic. One grew tired of their endless repetition. With a group of my workmen students, I entered the Soviet room. Instead of the original 12, there were now present 300 or 400 men. It seems that anyone who aspires to can become a member of the body. A very informal election indeed. In the overcrowded room, full of tobacco smoke, wild harangues were being delivered, more than one at a time. On the way to the room where the executive committee of the Duma was sitting, I met one of the members, Mr. Efremov, and learned from him that the struggle between the committee and the Soviet had begun in earnest, and that a dual power was now contending for control of the revolution. Mr. Efremov, greatly agitated, feared that the efforts of the Duma to reach an agreement with the Soviet were hopeless. He foresaw the substitution of responsible government by the mob. "But what can we do?" he asked despairingly. "Who is acting in the name of the Soviet? Is it not possible to order soldiers to arrest these men and disperse the Soviet?" I asked. "Such aggression and conflict cannot take place in the first days of the revolution," was the reply. "Then get ready for your own dismissal very soon," I warned him. "Were I a member of your committee, I would act immediately. The Duma is still the highest authority in Russia." In the midst of our conversation, an officer burst into the room demanding to be conducted to the committee of the Duma. "What has happened?" we asked. "All the officers of the Baltic Fleet are being murdered by soldiers and sailors," he cried, his face pallid with excitement. "The committee must interfere." My heart turned to ice. It was madness to expect a revolution without some bloodshed. Yet as the officer hurried on to the committee, which would doubtless do it best to save the human life, what would its best amount to? I learned that markets were being plundered wholesale by the people. Very late at night I reached home. No joy was in my soul, yet I bade myself hope. Tomorrow things might be better. Tomorrow, things were not better. In the streets, the same unruly crowds, the same motor cars with men firing wildly, the same manhunt of policemen and counter-revolutionaries. In the Duma, we received definitive news that the Tsar was to abdicate. The old regime had undoubtedly perished. In both Petrograd and Moscow, the population is as joyful as at Easter. Everyone acclaims the new regime and the Republic. Liberty, holy liberty, is everywhere shouted and sung. Wonderful revolution, revolution without blood, pure as the robes of sinless angels. I've heard this last from crowds of students parading the streets. It is all quite true, of course. Bloodshed has not been very terrible. If there are no further victims of the fanatics, our revolution may yet go down in history as the Bloodless Revolution. Long live the Bloodless Revolution. The political immigrants continue to return. In a few days are expected the Bolshevist leaders, Lenin, Trotsky, Zinoviev and others. They are returning through Germany with the assistance of the German government, which has loaned them a special wagon. Some of our people are indignant with the provisional government, which permitted these persons to return. The rumour is spreading that Lenin and his companions, about 40 men, were hired by the German staff to incite civil war in Russia and still further to demoralize the Russian army. I know not if this is true, but if it is, what can the government do to prevent it? By the inflamed masses, any attempt on the government's part would be regarded as counter-revolution. Lenin and his companions have arrived. Their first speeches at the Bolshevist conference embarrassed even members of the extreme left. Lenin and his group are now very rich men. And as a consequence, the number of Bolshevist newspapers, pamphlets, proclamations, etc. have greatly increased. Trotsky has taken a very expensive apartment. Where did all this money come from? That is the question. Socialization has begun. the Bolshevik have forcibly taken possession of the villa of the Dantsa Kashinsky, the anarchists have seized the villa of Duralvo and other houses, the owners being summarily expelled. Although they have appealed to the courts and to the government, nothing has been done to restore their property. Side by side with Bolshevist speakers stand others defending the policies of the government. Violent speeches are often followed by fights. About noon today came a rumour that two regiments, fully armed, had left their barrack to support the rioters. Firing began. Sacking of shops by criminals became general. The situation resembled the first days of the revolt, but in those days citizens were able to control the masses. Late last night, the rioters were momentarily dispersed, but they had already achieved their purpose. The government has announced that Milyukov is to be dismissed. This means the government has fallen, for this first concession to the mob and to the Bolshevik is the beginning of the end of the provisional government. We are all living on the edge of a volcano, and at any moment an eruption may burst forth. Not a pleasant situation, but step by step we manage to adapt ourselves to it. At any rate, it is all interesting enough. The abyss has opened at last. Bolshevism has conquered. It was all very simple. The provisional government and the first all-Russian Soviet were overthrown as easily as was the Tsarist regime. Through their military committees of revolution, the Bolshevik got control of the regiments. Through the Petrograd Workers' Soviet, they became masters of the working classes. These soldiers and Petrograd workmen commandeered all automobiles in the street, occupied the Winter Palace, the fortress, the railway stations, the telephones, and the post. To destroy the old government and to establish the new required only 24 hours. Lying ill all day on my bed, I listened to the steady booming of the cannon and the spatter of machine guns and crack of rifles. Over the telephone, I learned that the Bolshevik had brought up the warship Aurora and had opened fire on the Winter Palace, demanding the surrenders of members of the provisional government still barricaded there. At 7 in the evening, I went to the Municipal Duma. With many matters before us, the immediate horror that faced us was the situation at the Winter Palace. There, a regiment of women and military cadets were bravely resisting an overwhelming force of Bolshevist troops, and over the telephone, Minister Konovalov was appealing for aid. Poor women, poor lads, their situation was desperate, for we knew that the wild sailors, after taking the palace, would probably tear them to pieces. What could we do? After breathless counsel, it was decided that all of us, the Soviets, municipalities, committees of socialist parties, members of the Council of the Republic, should go in procession to the Winter Palace and do our utmost to rescue the ministers, the women soldiers, and the cadets. But even as we prepared to go, over the telephone came the despairing shout. The gates of the palace have been forced. The massacre has begun. Hurry, the mob has reached the first floor. All is over. Goodbye. They break in, they are... That last word of Konovalov from the Winter Palace was a broken cry. Kerensky is defeated. The Bolsheviks have taken the banks, state and private, and my former friend Pyatakov has been made Commissary of Finance. From the front comes new tales of horror. Generalissimo Dukhonin has been murdered with hundreds of other officers. Our army is now a wild, flying mob which destroys everything that stands in its path. German invasion is inevitable. Today, again, I narrowly escaped arrest. As I entered the courtyard of our building, a band of prosecutors followed me, some going to the office, others remaining at the gate. Fortunately, they did not know me by sight, and as it was dark, I lingered outside, devising plans of escape. One of our printers emerged from the doorway. I called him and explained my plight. Just a moment, he said, and in a few minutes he came back with a certificate identifying me as of the working force. At the gate, we were stopped and our certificates demanded. We showed them, and the guard said gruffly, "Pass on." So again, the mouse escaped. It is an interesting fact that this persecution is conducted by the very men who a few days ago were loudest in clamoring for a free press. Our daily menu at home becomes exotic. There is no bread, but yesterday we found at a small shop a few tins of preserved peaches. For bread, we prepare cake from potato skins and find it not too awful to swallow. Long life to the revolution, which stimulates invention and makes the people more modest in their appetites and desires. This is the last day of 1917. I look back on the year with feelings of bitterness and disillusionment. The year 1917 gave us the revolution, but what has revolution brought to my country but ruin and disgrace? Has it brought us freedom? Has it bettered the condition of the people? No. The face of revolution unveiled is the face of a beast, of a vicious and wicked prostitute, not that of the pure goddess which has been painted by historians of other revolutions. I could pray that these historians themselves might live through a real revolution. We do not know who will save our Russia, but whatever sorrows lie before you now, dear country, you shall not perish. From these ashes you shall rise, a great country and a great nation, a power among the powers of the earth. The prospects for 1918 are very dark. But come what may, I believe in my country and its historical mission. Sooner or later, we shall find the way out. Be blessed every day and night, my beloved country.